Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We go through the gate's closed, we'll go over the fence is too high, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in, but we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security, and for the important role that it'll play in reducing the deficit.
I didn't choose to tackle this issue to get some legislative victory under my belt. And by now, it should be fairly obvious that I didn't take on health care because it was good politics. I took on health care because the stories I've heard from Americans with pre-existing conditions whose lives depend on getting coverage.
Welcome to the Savage Nation. We have two narcissistic egomaniacs running America off the rails. And I'm going to put them in context, not in their place, but in context. So play a little. That's Coltrane, I hope. It is. He's the only one that'll work today. Welcome to the program. Now, what I'm going to do today is advanced radio, you know, 907. It's a seminar for the 900 series of listener. Something that is going to require a little following to get there, and then you're going to love it. It's not too complicated. It's just going to take time. I'm going to trace the long arc between the character and the catcher in the rye, Holden Caulfield, and Barack Obama, who is still playing the outsider, even though he's the president. You see, J.D. Salinger died, and he wrote The Catcher in the Rye. You may not have heard of him, but his book, which was published in 1951, it was written in 1945, is still selling 250,000 copies a year. It's still taught in colleges, and there's a reason for it. A couple of years ago, or a year ago, I actually reviewed The Catcher in the Rye for the Savage Nation, and it wound up today on Breitbart TV, Michael Savage, reading from The Catcher in the Rye. It's not just me reading from it. I didn't just read it. I actually would read and stop and analyze what I was saying and why it's so important. And then Drudge posted it, and Breitbart posted it, and we're going to play it for you, the five-minute piece that I did. And I'm going to trace, as I say, the long arc between the character and The Catcher in the Rye, the immortal teenage protagonist, the twisted, rebellious Holden Caulfield, who was the predecessor of the beatnik of the 50s, then the hippie of the 60s, and then the progressives of today, who continue to see themselves as working against the system or working against the man. And it leads us right up to Barack Obama still playing the outsider, even though he's president. What Barack Obama did last night was frightening. I don't know if you actually understood the psychology of Obama last night, but it was, if you actually could understand what he did, forget the individual policy statements that he made. Some of them were so obscure that they have only circulated in underground college publications, what Obama said. The man proposed things that are only proposed in obscure college publications. I think this man has no concept of limitations, either his own or of the government. And as such, Obama places us all in danger. Furthermore, the speech was full of bluster and bombast, unctuous in tone, condescending in spirit. We the people didn't understand health care. We the people didn't understand budgets. We the people don't understand the Supreme Court's decision. We're the idiots, and he's brilliant. The community organizer is brilliant. Brilliant. This was an arrogant and awful demonstration of the ability of a delusional man to blame everyone. Even the left thinks it was muddled. Obama did not have a coherent philosophy. The theme of his speech was, I don't quit. It had nothing to do with America, did it? And that's why, the minute the show ended, I posted my feelings up on Michael Savage, which is very short, and I said more today. And there will be more today. Him insulting the Supreme Court in front of the entire world I don't know if it was a first. I know that Andrew Johnson, that was Andrew Jackson, excuse me, I believe, once said to the Supreme Court, now that you have ruled in force, meaning I have the military drop dead. So there's probably a precedent for a president overriding a Supreme Court. But you got to remember that the Supreme Court is an equal branch of government to the presidency. Equal, not inferior to. This tin pot dictator from Chicago thinks that he is the supreme leader and he is superior to other branches of government. The man is a clear and present danger to the survival of this republic, in case you don't know it. Now, any Democrat listening to this show would understand what the Constitution says, separation of powers, not a supreme dictator. So when he attacks the Supreme Court in front of the Congress, and the gang of Democrats stand up behind the Supreme Court members, all of whom sat still, stone-faced, including the liberals, such as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she didn't get up and say, thank you, President. She understood what a slap in the face it was to the institution of the Supreme Court. The man, as I told you, is Junior Doc Obama, and he'd like to become a full-blown Papa Doc Obama, and the only people who can stop him are you. The man is a danger. Pelosi is an out-of-control egomaniac. 20% of the American people want health care reform, most of whom are illegal aliens or are going to profit from it directly. 20% of the people really don't know what it means for them, and approximately 60% of them said, do not destroy the greatest medical system on earth. And yet Pelosi in a fright wig gets up and says, we're going to do it. We're going to vault over. We're going to parachute in, drop dead people. We don't care. So now how did we get here? How did we wind up with this arrogant adolescent Obama in the presidency? How did this happen? Little did I know that I'd wake up today and read that Catcher in the Rye author J.D. Salinger, you know, would die. He's 91 years old, dies at 91. God bless him. I hope I live that long. Son says he died of natural causes at his home. He lived for decades in self-imposed isolation in the small remote house in Cornish, New Hampshire. And as I say, he wrote The Catcher in the Rye. And I want to show you today the long arc between The Catcher in the Rye, that is Holden Caulfield and Barack Obama, who is still playing the outsider, who is still playing, in essence, the teenage protagonist, the twisted, rebellious Holden Caulfield in the presidency. From the beatnik to the hippie to the progressive, today on The Savage Nation. And I will play what was posted up on Breitbart and Drudge and michaelsavage.com. You could play it yourself on your computer. But I want to read you a few pieces from The Catcher in the Rye. I still have my edition. It's falling apart. I have a paperback Signet book edition, 50 cents. Not the rap artist who probably has never read a book, but he's done very well indeed because that's America today. But Salinger wrote the book in 1945 and it was published in 53 by Little Brown and Company. And so, anyway, he writes this book, and it's about this character, this college guy, goes to a prep school, rich kid, and he's, he's kind of alienated. The character is an alienated character, and he doesn't really know what he is or what he wants to be. And I'm going to go to page 57, and he goes to this cheap hotel room in Manhattan. They gave me this very crummy room with nothing to look out of the window at except the other side of the hotel, he writes. I didn't care much. I was too depressed to care whether I had a good view or not. Now, let me pause right there. He said I was too depressed to care whether I had a good view or not. Remember, he wrote this in 1945. This was the first post-war book about an alienated character that I know of. He predated characters in the movie such as Montgomery Clift. Do you understand the characters I'm talking about? The outsider, the guy who was in the undershirt smoking, looking in from the outside. He predated a guy like Frank Sinatra's Italian guy, the little guy who fought until he got killed by the big guy. Remember that character? He played that character. He wrote about them. So he's in a cheap hotel, no view. He says, I don't care. I was too depressed to care whether I had a good view or not. The bellboy that showed me to the room was this very old guy around 65. I'm laughing for a reason. He was even more depressing than the room was. He was one of those bald guys that comb all their hair over from the side to cover up the baldness. I'd rather be bald than do that. Anyway, what a gorgeous job for a guy around 65 years old, carrying people's suitcases and waiting around for a tip. I suppose he wasn't too intelligent or anything, but it was terrible anyway. Now, this is, again, Salinger writing through his character, Holden Caulfield. And the kid now goes on, the character says this. After he left, I looked out the window for a while with my coat on and all. I didn't have anything else to do. You'd be surprised what was going on the other side of the hotel. They didn't even bother to pull their shades down. I saw one guy, a gray-haired, very distinguished-looking guy with only his shorts on, do something you wouldn't believe me if I told you. First, he put his suitcase on the bed. Then he took out all these women's clothes and he put them on. Real women's clothes, silk stockings, high-heeled shoes, brassiere, and one of those corsets with the straps hanging down and all. Then he put on this very tight black evening dress, I swear to God. Then he started walking up and down the room, taking these very small steps, the way a woman does, and smoking a cigarette and looking at himself in the mirror. He was all alone, too, unless somebody was in the bathroom. I couldn't see that much. Then in the window, almost right over his, I saw a man and a woman squirting water out of their mouths at each other. Now, I want to pause right here. This was very, very risky for 1951. You see the topics he touched on through the character, the alienated character? And what was Salinger trying to say through his character, Holden Caulfield? That the kid was mixed up and alienated because society was mixed up and alienated. Already America had had the big crack-up. And so today I'm going to continue with long pieces of The Catcher in the Rye and long pieces of the mad woman Pelosi and the egomaniac adolescent Obama. And I am again going to make connections between the long arc that connects the character in The Catcher in the Rye and Barack Obama still playing the outsider, still playing the alienated teenager, even though he is the president. From beatnik to hippie to progressive to the savage nation, I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to Cafe Savage. It's winter 2010. We have an adolescent narcissist running America. You want to put it almost in a psychological setting. We have an adolescent narcissist as president and almost Alan Bates as Speaker of the House. Alan Bates in drag as Speaker of the House, if you want to put it into like a nutty analogy. So it's one of those days where make believe I'm the cafe owner and you've come in and I'm doing a reading. I mean, I could play the whole speech from last night and comment on it, which I planned on doing. And I will in and out, or Pelosi's insanities and inanities. I can do that. But you've heard it, and you can hear it. But what I'm going to do instead is what I started to do, which is you can't catch this anywhere else. Salinger dies, he wrote The Catcher in the Rye. It doesn't matter whether he went to college or not. You don't have to have gone anywhere. The book was about a 16-year-old Holden Caulfield who wants to find himself, but he goes underground in New York for 48 hours because he's overwhelmed by the perplexing circumstances of his life. And what happens to him is interesting. Now, you should know that Salinger himself lived to 91. What's left out of the Wikipedia article about him, because it would make him look too American, Salinger served in the military from 42. He went to a military academy because he was a rebellious kid. So the parents sent him to a military academy. Then he went to three colleges. Then he went 42 to 46. Salinger was in the Army. He served in D-Day, the invasion of Normandy, saw action there. All of this left out of Wikipedia because it would make him look too American. You get it? So instead they have to repaint him even in order for you to get the whole picture that apparently wasn't even in the war. So Salinger was like an American all the way through and through. I don't know what his politics were, nor do I care. His politics don't matter to me. His art is what matters to me. So we're talking about the character, because that way I can integrate my interest in the book and how important it's been in America, which leads me to the next question to you. Maybe no one ever read this. Has anyone out there ever read Catcher in the Rye, and did it affect you in any way? Just throw out what you remember. Did it change you? It changed me. See, the point is that in many ways, all of my rebellion, all of my early years of rebellion, maybe to this minute, maybe my years on radio, I don't know. I'm still playing Holden Caulfield for all I know. The difference is I'm not president. The difference is I'm smart enough to understand that we can't have somebody who is an entertainer in the presidency. And right now we have an entertainer who's in the presidency. He doesn't even understand the power he has and how he's abusing it and how he's trying to wreck this great republic and its institutions. That's the point I'm trying to make. So, you can do that if you want to make it participatory. But again, I want to go back for a moment to the book itself and read you little snippets. And then I'm going to play the piece that's up on my website, michaelsavage.com, from Breitbart, which I was very pleased that Andrew found it and posted it. He didn't tell me he was going to do it. It's not like an old boys club. It shows, the headline says, catcher in the Rye author J.D. Salinger dies. And then he links up Michael Savage reads The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. I had no idea YouTube had me doing this. I mean, somebody had, somebody had posted it on YouTube, me doing it. Salinger wrote for adults, but teenagers all over the world identify with the novel's themes of alienation, innocence, and fantasy. In later years, Salinger became famous for not wanting to be famous, refusing interviews. Isn't that interesting? Refusing interviews. So different than all of the losers in our society today who would literally drown their child in a bathtub to get on Nancy Grace. Not to say the least of which is the vermin in the media who would have them on, you know. Anyway, you want me to do this, or do you want Mike to go on to meat and potatoes? What do you want today? Do you want a souffle, or do you want to just eat a pot roast on the Savage Nation? What would you like? You got to tell me what you want. I mean, it's your show. I'm not going to just do this because I want to do it, and I do want to do it. I want to stick to this theme of the long arc between this alienated character in The Catcher in the Rye and this alienated character, or the man acting to be alienated, Barack Obama, who's still acting like, oh, I'm the outsider. I'm just the angry man. I'm angry at the man. We got to get the man. We got to up the system, man. You know, oh, God, don't you see it? Don't you see this guy's act? I mean, if you don't see it by now, then, you know, you don't even understand the bigger picture yet thematically. In order to understand Obama politically, you have to understand him thematically. In order to understand him thematically, you have to understand him psychologically. In order to understand him psychologically, maybe we can start with some literary analysis and then talk about psychological analysis, which I was the first to do in the United States of media. I talked about the man's mother complex. I wrote about Obama's woman problem back in the beginning. You remember any of this? I'm not looking for any points to do this. I'm looking to wake you up to the danger you are in, left, right, and center. I don't care if the man was a liberal, but he's imbalanced and he's narcissistic. And those are the people who get you in trouble. Those are the people who ruin a nation. Look what Bill Clinton did to this country.
Savage. Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com.
We move away from Wallbanger and golfer territory, and we get into Talk Radio 903. This is an advanced class. And you say, well, why are you doing it? You're trying to sound smart. You're being an intellectual. We don't like it. Do Tea Party stuff. Be a Tea Partier. You know, just do the stuff. No, that's not why. I'm doing it because, yeah, you can bash Obama all you want, but unless you understand where he came from and how a guy like that could be put into the presidency and the American people could be so hoodwinked, it could happen again. And in order to prevent this from ever happening again, you have to understand who he is metaphorically. And in order to do that, you have to understand the long arc between a book such as The Catcher in the Rye. Probably predates him. I can take it back to Baudelaire if you want to go into French literature, but I'm not going to go there. I'm going to go back to Holden Caulfield and The Catcher in the Rye and lead you right up to Barack Obama still playing the outsider, even though he's president. And that's the whole thing. You know, the whole thing of the left is to constantly complain and make believe there's more work to do. No matter what you give them, they're like nymphomaniacs. There's more work to do. It's not equal rights anymore. We want more than equal rights. It's not we shall overcome. Now that we've overcome, we want to really crush you. It's not we shall overcome. We shall crush you. See how it works? More, more, more. Give more. Give, take more from those who create the country and the jobs. Take it from them and give it to the bums. Give it to the illegal alien. Give it to the bum. You know, you want to get me started? You want to get me mad? Or I'll get myself mad. I'm driving to the studio today. I see a 15-year-old husband and a 14-year-old wife with a baby in a carriage walking around outside Section 8 housing today in a rich neighborhood. They did this. And here's this bum, these two bums. They had a baby, and they got a free apartment, free everything. In the middle of a work day, they're pushing a baby around. You think my mother and father pushed a baby around when they were youngsters with children, didn't have anything? My father worked 7 days a week. He didn't have the government giving him a handout. guy looked like an illegal alien to me on top of it all. But he got the wife, and he got the baby. He got the meal ticket and the baby. The birther. He got the birther right there. And this is what Obama wants more of in this country, I said to myself. I really was fuming in the car as I drove by. I see all. I see all. My eyes see all. My eyes are dimming a bit. Sometimes I think they're dimming on purpose. I hope not. It's probably from using the computer or whatever. But I see it all. Nothing passes my eye. I could see it in a fleeting moment. And I see the whole picture right there. Why should these two bums be walking around in the middle of the day with a baby while I'm paying their bills through my high taxes? I say to myself, that's who they want to give health care to? That's what the whole argument is over, bums like that? They should be cleaning the gutter if they're not capable of doing anything else, I said to myself. You got filthy streets, you got potholes that need to be filled. They want welfare, let them work 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day sweeping the gutters, then give them a welfare check or give them government cheese. I couldn't believe my eyes. Now, what does this have to do with this? It has everything to do with it and nothing to do with it. Mark in New York, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go on, what do you think? What do you think? What do you know? What do you know?
Well, I'm a big collector of wise adages, and what attracted me to Salinger was the adage toward the end, you know, an immature person wants to die nobly for a cause, a mature person wants to live humbly for one.
Yes, 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 that's beautiful. I'm going to play something for you, Mark. When I reviewed the book verbally, or orally, shall I say, on the show, when was this, Beowulf? In 08, I think? I think so, when we did it. 09, sometime this year. I don't know what brought it up. That's exactly what I quoted. 1-800-449-8255. Thanks. No gifts today. Not in the gift-giving mood. That's too much to balance. So only women want me to read Catcher today. The men don't care. They want me to do the wall banger stuff and the regular. So to do a little bit of regular for the average guy who's ready to turn the show off and go to the ball game here. Let's play Pelosi again. The angry Madame Defarge of American politics. The vindictive, arrogant, out of touch, anti-American Pelosi in clip 3.
We go through the gate. The gate's closed. We'll go over the fence. The fence is too high. We'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in. But we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security, and for the important role that it'll play in reducing the deficit.
Now, I only wish that Pelosi had the same passion, to use an overused word, for defeating al-Qaeda that she has for defeating the American taxpayer. If only she had worked herself up. If only the Joint Chiefs of Staff had gotten up. Mullen, the guy who looks good in a suit, but looks like an usher in a movie theater to me, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who will not have the Navy fire a shot at a pirate. If only he had gotten up and said, well, if we don't defeat them, initially we'll go over the fence. If the fence is too high, we'll pole vault. And if that doesn't work, we'll parachute in. But we're going to defeat al-Qaeda. No matter what. Oh, that's what I wanted to hear. But instead, what is Pelosi excited about? Defeating the American taxpayer. You hear this? Leslie, Sacramento, go ahead, please.
Yes, I think she's the definition of insanity. And I really, really wish you would go ahead and just do the Catcher in the Rye correlation with everything that you're doing today.
Are you understanding what I try to do here, the long arc between the Catcher in the Rye character and Obama, the outsider?
Yes, and I think that it could really explain so much more to people if they just give it a chance, because I have been
It does require thinking, because it's not heard elsewhere. It's original to this show. It's original to me. Make believe this is sort of a conversation. Thanks for the call. So without further ado, what I want to do for you now, because it's a real treat, you can get it off michaelsavage.com if you can't listen right now. I want you to hear what I had to say about The Catcher in the Rye about a year ago. Listen. One of the books that I read when I was young was, everyone read it, The Catcher in the Rye. It's still out there by J.D. Salinger. He doesn't give interviews. Basically, he's like me. No, I'm joking. I'm like him. I don't blame him. But he lives in Vermont. I could never live there, like in a place like that. Like in a farmhouse. First of all, everything's changed, number one. Even the thought of getting away from it all. You wind up living next to a crack a crank laboratory or a Mexican mafia drug farm. I mean, if you move, oh, I'm leaving the area. It's terrible. I want to live in, I'm going to buy 100 acres in California, Utah. You wake up the next day, it's like a meth lab next to you, some guy without teeth, or they're growing pot in the national forest, and the feds are afraid of them. They don't even go in there by black. They won't even use a black hawk to look for it, because it's liable to show that the illegal immigrants are. So one of the books that everybody read was The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. I have the picture. Remember the kid? Remember Caulfield? That was such an important book in my era. But I understand it's still taught in college, Catcher in the Rye, because he was 1945, J.D. Salinger. Now, what he represented, this character in The Catcher in the Rye, was the alienated kid, right? Remember that one? So there's a page, and I got to read to you, where he talks to one of his friends, and he says to him, I have a feeling that you're writing for some kind of a terrible, terrible fall, but I don't honestly know what kind. Are you listening to me? Yes. He says, you may be the kind where at the age of 30, you sit in some bar hating everybody who comes in, looking as if he might have played football in college. Then again, you may pick up just enough education to hate people and say, it's a secret between he and I. Or you may end up in some business office throwing paper clips at the nearest stenographer. I just don't know, but do you know what I'm driving at all? Yeah, sure I did. But you're wrong about blah, blah, blah. So the next page in The Catcher in the Rye says, he's this fall I think you're writing for. It's a special kind of fall, a horrible kind. The man falling isn't permitted to feel or hear himself hit bottom. He just keeps falling and falling. The whole arrangement's designed for men who at some time or other in their lives were looking for something their own environment couldn't supply them with, or they thought their own environment couldn't supply them with, so they gave up looking. They gave it up before they ever really got started. You follow me? Yes, sir. Sure. He got up and poured some more booze in his glass, then he sat down again. He didn't say anything for quite a long time. He says, I don't want to scare you, he said, but I can very clearly see you dying nobly one way or another for some highly unworthy cause. You know, so then the guy says, the mark of the immature man is that he wants to die nobly for a cause, while the mark of the mature man is that he wants to live humbly for one. Are you following me how good this is, why this book is still taught? He leaned over and they're talking. He says, I think that one of these days you're going to have to find out where you want to go, and then you got to start going there. But immediately, you can't afford to lose a minute, not you. And I hate to tell you, but I think that once you have a fair idea where you want to go, your first move will be to apply yourself in school. You'll have to. You're a student whether the idea appeals to you or not. You're in love with knowledge, and I think you'll find once you get past all the Mr. this and their oral comp that, blah, blah, blah. Should I read this to you right now? I mean, I'll tell you why I'm reading it to you in a minute. So he says, you're by no means alone in that score. You'll be excited and stimulated to know. Many, many men have been just as troubled morally and spiritually as you are right now. Happily, some of them kept records of their troubles. You'll learn from them, if you want to. Just as someday, if you have something to offer, someone will learn something from you. It's a beautiful reciprocal arrangement, and it isn't education, it's history, it's poetry. He stopped and took a big drink out of his highball. He said, I'm not trying to tell you that only educated and scholarly men are able to contribute something valuable to the world. It's not so. But I do say that educated and scholarly men, if they're brilliant and creative to begin with, which unfortunately is rarely the case, tend to leave infinitely more valuable records behind them than men do who are merely brilliant and creative. They tend to express themselves more clearly, and they usually have a passion for following their thoughts through to the end. And most important, 9 times out of 10, they have more humility than the unscholarly thinker. Do you follow me at all? These are underlines from when I read the book when I was young. Now, the reason I'm reading from my edition of Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, it's falling apart already, a paperback version, is because men of my generation were formed by certain ideas and by certain books. This was an important book that was a big part of my growing up. Now, you compare it to today. I mean, what are they teaching anybody? They don't even know the difference between... Well, what's the difference? Why? I made my point. That's all.
Savage.
All right. Now, what does it have to do with politics? Everything and nothing. I mean, you can make a linkage, which I've been trying to do today, which I'd like to do, but I think it's very important for you to understand that Obama is running as though he's still an outsider, an alienated character, and an adolescent. He's still playing the oppressed minority, and he's still playing up on the game of the superior virtue of the oppressed, which is another book that influenced me. It was actually a small short essay by Bertrand Russell, The Superior Virtue of the Oppressed, as enacted by Barack Obama. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I know that there are those who disagree with the overwhelming scientific evidence on climate change. But here's the thing. Even if you doubt the evidence, providing incentives for energy efficiency and clean energy are the right thing to do for our future.
So even though the science is fraudulent, even though the whole thing is a lie, even though it's all about rewarding Nancy Pelosi's supporters with green contracts, which are better than recycling. In fact, it's better than the garbage business, the green contracts. I understand it's better than the carting business. Green contracts today are bigger than The Sopranos. So even though the science is false, go along with it because I say so. Who are you going to believe, me or science? And even if you don't believe the science, go along with it anyway because I say so. New York City, WOR, Mike, you're on The Savage Nation.
Hello, Michael Savage. I have your books. I respect you, but I disagree with you strongly. Barack Obama is not an entertainer. He's a con artist. He's an outpatient. He's a manipulator. I grew up in Coney Island. I know what a huckster is. How could you call him an entertainer? You're an entertainer. I'm shocked. I'm pissed off. Listen, after that speech, did you feel entertained? No, you felt like finding a vomit bag. Come on, pull yourself
after
together,
after the speech. Mind. After the speech, I felt that we were all in danger, mortal danger.
Totally, I spotted him immediately, just like you did, and you helped me fix it. He lies when he stands. We lie when we sleep.
That's very funny. Good. So, what do you mean you grew up in Coney Island? He reminds you of what type in Coney Island?
The first job I had was down near the rides. I made jelly apples July 4th. He reminds me of the guys behind the booth, and he says, "Hey, come on, knock it down. You got a Cupid doll." Meanwhile, the whole thing is manipulations. It's all rigged.
Oh, I remember those things. There was no way to throw the ring into a certain thing. I remember that. I used to try. Nobody could do it.
Absolutely.
So I'm only an entertainer to you. That's all you get out of me is a good laugh?
I didn't say only an entertainer.
I'm joking. Come on. It's a sensitive issue because the left attacks me. I don't really care anymore. My favorite teachers were entertaining, so that I understand. And today, what do you do? Do you own Coney Island today?
No, I'm in the Coney Island, USA. Come on. I called before. I'm a retired police officer. I'm a teacher who was knife-armed by the New York City Department of Education because they didn't like somebody of my stature in the classroom.
Your former New York Police Department, you mean you were NYPD when it was NYPD?
Absolutely, yes. My uncle was the captain of the precinct. My mother said, don't get into trouble. You ruin Uncle Sam's reputation.
Unbelievable. So you're a listener on WOR, huh?
Not only am I a listener, but I have a card, and I say, dethrone Cuckoo Obama, and the pun is intended.
Well, I'm going to send you Band in Britain, even if you have one. Give it away to your favorite huckster on Coney Island's boardwalk. Stay on the line, Mike. You win a free copy of Band in Britain, and you didn't even have to throw the Cupid doll into the hoop. And you can't throw it. You can't throw a Cupid doll into the hoop. You have to throw something into the hoop to get the Cupid ball. Florida, Greg, you're up on the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Yeah, Mike, I think this correlation you're developing between Salinger's sort of existential isolationism goes directly into Jack Kerouac's adventurous, traveling soul existentialism, and I think it's going to lend itself in this current climate to a sort of a new existentialism among people just searching for their meaning in society today.
It's very interesting you should bring up Jack Kerouac because he was an immense influence in my life, very big influence. I read him in 1957. As a result of him, I went on the road and drove myself halfway around the globe collecting plants, doing whatever. And so, no, he had a great influence upon me. What people don't know about Jack Kerouac, and the thing that the left lies about Jack Kerouac, is that he was a lifetime conservative. At the end of his days, he hated Allen Ginsberg and the communists because he knew that they were evil. And yet they continue to paint Jack Kerouac as though he were a left-winger when he never was.
Well, he even rebelled against Leary, Timothy Leary, you know, and all his experiments, you know. So
I do know that. In fact, Kerouac died totally alienated from the beatniks that he hung around with because he saw them for what they were and what they weren't. And he went down and lived with his mother, and he lived in a little shack, basically, a little house down there in some horrible place, and drank himself to death at a very young age in total misery. But remember, he had been molested by Allen Ginsberg at Columbia University. He was a football player, and that communist pervert NAMBLA member seduced him when he was stoned one day and perennially ruined his life ever since that point. This is a little-known factor about that whole beatnik thing that is never taught in colleges today.
Well, you know, I guess somebody could write a book saying Barack Obama and the new existentialism.
But why do you say the new existentialism with regard to Barack Obama? Why? What is he? You're not saying he represents the alienation that you're reflecting, are you?
Well, you know, because people for so long have been dependent on government, rather than take matters into their own hands. And I think he is proving people
wrong.
Yeah,
they're very upset that the American people actually spoke. Pelosi shocked that the people were stirred up on the reservations and stood up. And they, the so-called Tea Party movement that they basically debase. It's the American voice. It's the American people. It is democracy in action. It is the Republic acting up against the dictatorship of Barack, Harry, and Nancy. That's what they hate. They hate the people. They want serfs, illegal aliens, and people on welfare.
Savage.
Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We'll go over the fence. The fence is too high. We'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in. But we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security, and for the important role that it'll play in reducing the deficit.
The more that TV pundits reduce serious debates to silly arguments, big issues into sound bites, our citizens turn away. No wonder there's so much cynicism out there. No wonder there's so much disappointment.
Who's the drummer in this? This is the Topsy Part 1 that I like the most. Certainly better than Barack Obama, than Nancy Lugosi. Nancy Lugosi. So in the first hour, Posey Cole. I remember when I first heard this music, how it changed a lot of my thinking about music. When I first heard Fats Domino, changed my thinking about a lot of things. And so, turn it off already now. They can't follow. It's a dual track. It's hard. Anyone born before a certain age, they can't do it. A book can change your thinking, right? A song can change your thinking. A tune can change your thinking, et cetera, and so on. So what I'm saying is America has been, moving, evolving over these centuries. And in last century, I'm tracing the long arc between the catcher and the rye, J.D. Salinger, the character Holden Caulfield, the eternal outsider, the adolescent, and Barack Obama still playing the outsider, the angry outsider, even though he is the president. From beatnik to hippie to progressive, it's the same game. The same game is we shall overcome, and then when we get what we want, we'll still say it's not enough, give us more. Give us more, give us more, give us more. There's no end to the demands. And that's why you have Obama. The man's president, but he's still trying to turn a trick, as it were, and turn us magico presto into the Soviet Union. And so the people say, wait a minute, we don't want this. 60% of the people said no to the health care reform once they found that it was not health care reform. It was just stealing the greatest health care system the world had ever seen, despite all of its faults and all of its, inefficiencies. He wants to destroy it and turn it into something that nobody wants except illegal aliens, and the grifters are going to make a fortune off it. But she says we're going to do it anyway. He then attacks the Supreme Court, and in an age of terror, instead of saying we're going to give the military anything they want, he says we're going to give them don't ask, don't tell. The military leaders sit there stone-faced, unmoving. He attacks the Supreme Court, an institution equal to the presidency. Remember, separate but equal. Equal institution, separation of powers. It's the judiciary. It's equal to him, but he doesn't think so because he's Obama. He's not just the president. He is superior to everyone else. He is at the tip of the entire pyramid. He is Obama the Magnificent. He is the eye. He is e pluribus unum. He is the eye blinking atop the pyramid in his own mind. And so he attacks the Supreme Court in front of the goons in the Democrat Party who get up and jeer them like a gang, like a gang, like a gang. And he wonders why there's so much cynicism out there. Mr. Obama, tear down that stall that you are living in. Mr. Obama, tear down that stall you are speaking in. Mr. Obama, tear down that stall you are speaking in. After listening to the State of the Union address by him last night, my first reaction, as I wrote, was one of overwhelming shock that this man's ego and narcissism was so apparent. My head is spinning, I wrote, from the number of items this man plans to do after he has already wrecked his party's chances of getting reelected. Wrecked virtually everything he has touched. This man goes on and on and on with one left-wing policy position after another. Each one more unpopular than the other one. Whatever he says, he thinks that it's important to do. Illegal aliens in every town, excellent. Gays in the military, long overdue. Cutting this? Fine. Tax those who build the economy and create jobs? That's great. Tax the rich? That's excellent. But it didn't end there. See, at a time like this, we needed a very short, somber speech saying, I know things are bad. We're going to fix it. Here's what we're going to do. Thank you very much. 5 minutes would have been enough. Instead, the man brought out a shopping list of every liberal program ever created by a bureaucrat, no matter how obscure. From the small to the large, this man threw it out as though it was something important. Now, this is indicative of an imbalanced president. This is indicative of a man with an ego that is not only outsized, but I believe goes into the territory of delusional narcissism. The man is delusional as to who he is, what his role in history is, and more importantly, delusional as to what he can hope to accomplish in times such as these. Believe me, this is a sad commentary for me to make about the president of the United States, but this man frightens me. I think Obama could get us all whacked. I think he's out of control with his own hubris. I believe this man has no concept of the times we are living in. And believe me, the times they are a-changing. So play Topsy if you have it, because you don't have the times they are a-changing, because I just threw it at you. I'll pitch, you catch. I'll pitch, you catch. I'll pitch, you catch. I'll pitch, you catch. Catcher in the Rye author J.D. Salinger has died at age 91. He was a wild guy, although he lived like a, like you'd think like a monk. Like, you hear, like, oh, he lived to 91, he lived alone in a little house up in New Hampshire, and he was a recluse. Well, you don't know about the babes, the whole story, you know. Always the girls in his life. He wrote letters to young women who fell in love with him, came and visited to interview him. They wound up staying for like a few years. Salinger, Maynard later writes in her own memoir how she came to find out that Salinger had begun relationships with young women by exchanging letters. One of those letter recipients included Salinger's current wife, a nurse, who was already engaged to be married to someone else when she met the author. It's a cagey old fox. You know, he didn't have to go to bars. He stood up in his little cabin and sent letters. In those days, there were women who would read letters. Today, no one reads letters. It's the internet. Everything's written like in a telegram with pictures. Wasn't that? I mean, he's a goofy-looking guy in a way. I know what he looked like. Let's not go into it. Why did Marilyn Monroe marry Joe DiMaggio? You talk about upset imagery in my mind as a child. When I was a kid and I saw Marilyn Monroe's sex goddess with, what's his name? I just said it for Eddie. I forgot. Not Joe DiMaggio. No, he was a sports figure. That I understood. Arthur Miller. They were the similar type. Tall, lean, goofy looking, you know, very lean, lanky. So physically she was attracted to a lanky, large man. I understand that. But as a kid, I didn't understand why she'd go not with a ball player. That I understood. But for Marilyn Monroe to go with Arthur Miller, you know, he looked like an uncle... like an uncle from Brooklyn who was sort of like bookish. He looked like a commie with like a sweater with moths in it. And he occasionally went to the ILWU meetings in the 30s. And he like dated communist women with mustaches and very large bodies. I didn't understand that. I in fact, years later, of course, I loved Death of a Salesman and some of his other work. I don't think he was the greatest, you know, playwright in history. I like Eugene O'Neill much better, frankly. To me, the number one was Long Day's Journey and Tonight. I still get that title alone. Talk about what that meant. See, there was a whole period of alienation, writing about alienation in the 1950s. Why? Why was there so much writing about alienation in the 50s, which yielded the alienated youth culture of the 60s? It takes about 10 years for the leaders of the intellectual mind of America to have an impact upon the youth. 10 years. So if you say that now, say, well, who was writing in like 1999, 2000? And what's the influence going to be on kids now? Well, you don't have to ask yourself who was writing. All you got to do is look around at 13-year-old girls dressing up like prostitutes with their mother wearing the same outfit in the mall in white communities. The mothers and the daughters are dressing up like sluts, and they're best friends. Yo, we tell each other everything. Hey, that is so cool. Just what your daughter needed was a girlfriend, not a mother. She doesn't need a girlfriend in you. Stop competing with your daughters. Act like a mother. Let her be a child and lead her. Children know what the hell they're talking about. That's why they're called children. You're supposed to tell them what's going on. Not sit there on the rug with your face in like a, you know, your head in like a V on the rug next to them like you're equal. And say, well, what exactly is it that you think you would like for dinner tonight? I go in restaurants and I listen to you bring it down to food, Michael. I see liberal parents talking to like six-year-olds about dinner. The child doesn't even know what they're talking about. Would you prefer this? Would you like that? And I know starvation. Forget Haiti. I just know about starvation and the history and the deprivation. You don't do that with a child. Put a plate of food on the table and let them eat it. If they don't eat it, then go home. Let them go home hungry. They'll eat the next day. You can't do that with a child. Aunt. That's why when you feed a dog, if it doesn't eat it, pick it up and put it on the kitchen counter. Guarantee you the next time you put it down, it'll eat what you put down there. What is going on in the country? Who wrote the stuff? Well, you want to get into the influence of people on children. Let's talk about Dr. Spock one day. You want to have the influence of psychiatric or psychologists upon the psyche? You want to talk about the biggest phony in the history of the world of psychology? How about Mr. Kinsey, the faker? The demented, perverted faker, Kinsey. The report, the Kinsey report on sex, which he invented, made up, is now quoted in psychology journals as verbatim, the truth. Con men. Everywhere you turn, con men, con men, con men. Which leads us back to the presidency directly. Why does the man put out a shopping list of every left-wing fantasy in the world and smack the American people over the head with it? Everything. The whole thing. everything, even though he knows that they're wrong, unpopular, can't be passed, global warming, fraudulent, we're going to do it anyway. Destroying the health insurance industry, we know that it's a con and a scheme. Sopranos, we know you're trying to take over the insurance racket because there's a lot of money in it. We understand it. We don't want it. We're going to do it anyway. Don't ask, don't tell. We're going to do it anyway because we see these are all special interest groups. And then he attacks the Supreme Court to top it all off. If you weren't freaked out enough, then Mr. Obama attacks the Supreme Court and has his goon squad stand up and clap over their heads to scare them and intimidate them. He owes them an apology. Obama is an immature adolescent moron. He owes them an apology. I'll be back.
Savage.
Some writers and critics who prophesize with
Bobby!
And keep your eyes wide.
Bobby!
Come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming.
Maybe I'm the eternal Holden Caulfield, for all I know. Maybe this is the asylum in which I am spewing forth my adolescent view of the world. I'll let you decide. I'll let you decide who's right and who's wrong. I'll let you decide. Maybe you're in the asylum of your own mind. Maybe everybody in America is living inside their own asylum. Maybe the entire nation is a bug house. Maybe what we see up there in Obama and in Pelosi is a reflection of our own insanity. Let you decide. Let you decide. Who's Holden Caulfield? You? Me? Obama? Bob Dylan? Huckleberry Finn? Holden Caulfield was an updated Huckleberry Finn. How's that for a little jump? How's that for a jump cut?
Mothers and fathers,
yeah, whatever.
Throughout the land.
I think I'm going to take a vow of silence.
And don't criticize what you
Maybe I'll take a vow of silence. Hard to do in radio, though, and make a living. It's all about speaking, even when you don't want to talk.
Can't lend your hand, for the times they are changing.
Great article just came out, The Times of London. J.D. Salinger, author of The Catcher in the Rye by, I don't know who wrote it. It's really amazing. It covers the whole thing. I'm going to put it up on the website. But what's interesting, I got to say this. I shouldn't say it every day, but I can't believe the Drudge said he left the phonies finally, something like that. Finally left the world of the phonies. It's very touching. I mean, many people understand this guy and how important he is. Look, if you read Huckleberry Finn to your son, as I did, which I did, you know, why did I read Huckleberry Finn? Why would I read Huckleberry Finn to a young man, a kid, 8, 9 years old? I read Huckleberry Finn to my kid. Why? Why would I still read Huckleberry Finn written by Mark Twain? Well, I don't know. Why would you read anything to your children? What do you read to your children? What do you say? What do you know? Do you read to your children or you just let them watch DVDs? Or go onto the computer porn, safe for children, as declared by the Department of Education. Special computer porn site from the Department of Education, suitable for children under the age of 8. They'll determine the government said this kind of porn is suitable for children under the... Oh, it's a crazy world. Isn't it a mad, mad world? The Super Bowl, huh? Super Bowl. I don't even go. I'm in the Super Bowl. Everybody wants to go. I'm avoiding Miami. It's next weekend, right? What's today? Thursday? Blah, blah, blah. No, I'm not going. No, I'm not going to go. You know what I'm concerned about, ladies and gentlemen? I mean, now that I'm going to get off the track and on the track, I'm really trying to think about what to wear tomorrow for the picture, for the interview. No. The photographer's coming Thursday. The reporter's coming tomorrow. Then I could wear my regular, you know, garbage rags. If someone were to ask you, what should I wear or what should you wear? If you had one picture that's going to be seen around the world and maybe the last important publicity picture ever taken of you, but the best and the one that's liable to be the one that's left behind. Should I wear a tie and a white shirt? No, that's not you. But I actually look better dressed princely than I do pauperly. If I dress pauperly, I don't look good. I look like a pauper. So I may have to wear a tuxedo for the picture.
Savage. Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com.
I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing.
I was reaching in the during the break. I just got very manicky because I've been depressed all day for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe my Icelandic genes. I don't have any, but in the sense that we are all, you know, everyone is everyone and everything is everything. I may be Icelandic. I just had like a winter, like, you know, depression. The weather's been horrendous on the West Coast. I told you you were going to get hit with it, right? Like, you'd be a genius. 3 days later, you get what we had. It's like the, you know, like the flu. I mean, if we have it, you're going to get it. So we got a little sun today. Now it's horrible. It's dark. You know, it's miserable out there again. Cold. I'm getting tired of it. On the other hand, I don't want to go to the sun because I don't like the sun. So, you know, you have to face the fact that it has nothing to do with weather. So I was going through the library here in the Savage studio after that long, uplifting, manicky moment with Bob Dylan and the fun I've been having on the show today. What do I mean by fun? Ha ha, Happy the Clown? No. Fun means exercising my mental faculties. So if I connect the catcher in the rye to Obama, I'm having a good time because I've just used, you know, part of my mental energy that normally doesn't get used, and I've given it to you, and I hope that you enjoyed it thus far. That's all. It was all for you. I didn't do it for me. If I didn't have a radio show, would I have just done that? Who would I have done it for? Who was going to listen to me? I'm going to walk around in the street and stop someone and say, listen, I got something to tell you about the catcher in the rye? Oh, sure, mister. Right, tell me about it. All right, then call the police. So in other words, I did it for the millions of people who might be listening, some of whom might have enjoyed it, most of whom wouldn't. I know that most of you would rather listen to, you know, Wallbanger or the golfer hitting the ball about Obama, and I get it. But if you were to say to the golfer, what do you think about you know, Old English? He would have said, well, I prefer Old Lyme myself, or I always liked Old Lyme better. Because I was going through my bookcase after that, and I saw a book. It's a book I bought years ago. I haven't read it, called Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English by John McWhorter. And he's a linguist. A survey of the quirks and quandaries of the English language, focusing on our strange and wonderful grammar. But what he writes in this is that people say that English is easy. And he says, yes, it is compared to other languages. And he said, English is easy, mostly because Vikings and other invaders so battered the tongue that it became quite simple. You hear this? He also demolishes the claim that a people's culture is reflected in its language and concludes by looking at the interesting prehistory of English. The main thing is that he says, don't worry so much about grammar. He looks at English grammar and sentence construction and sees how it's changed over the centuries, and relates it to the Germanic languages, and ties it to the survival of Celtic grammatical forms after the Germanic tribes first invaded Britain. It's interesting, believe me. See, most of us speak, we don't even know we're speaking a language, let alone trying to transmit ideas. Have you ever stopped and thought about what words are? The power of the written word, the power of the spoken word? Do you have any idea the power you have, how a single word can condemn a man or a single word can save a man? Have you thought about how the power of words influences our life? How the power of a single sentence can change the shape or the course of human history? How the power of the use of words can shape and move history? And therefore, we come back to this sad sack that we have running America. You know, he speaks in a very impressive voice because he has good genes. He's a strong young man. He has a very powerful voice. And you want to believe him because he has the kind of voice that leaders should have. But this is what is called all sound and no substance. There's a word for it. It was known to the ancient Greeks. It was a school of thought, a school of a philosophy that was taught to the young men of ancient Greece, which was to speak without meaning. Speak without meaning. That's Obama. He's like a classic rhetorician in his own mind. To speak without meaning. He still thinks he's going up for the bar exam. He still thinks he's going up to pass some class. So when he gets up last night, instead of speaking for 5 to 8 minutes and said, look, we know we're in trouble. The country's in trouble. Maybe I've gone off course a little bit. Maybe I misread the American people because we are a republic. And I'm not here to dictate to you, and I want to listen to you, and I see what's going on. And I don't want to just give you, you know, platitudes about feeling your pain. I see you don't want me to wreck the healthcare system, so we're not going to do that. And we know you're concerned about free care for illegal aliens. We're not going to do that. And we're not going along with the global warming thing because we've since found out it was all fraudulent. The scientists should be in jail. We're going to defund all of this research. We're taking it apart from top to bottom. Instead of doing that and concluding by saying, we're going to do what you want, not what we want. This is not about us. It's about you. We understand your concerns. We're tightening the budget. There's a 10% cut across all federal departments. Immediately tomorrow, they're going to answer to me. That's what you wanted to hear. Instead, you got a shopping list of left-wing rhetoric. Every left-wing program that has ever been floated was thrown out last night. And so you say the guy is out of control. He's out of touch. I ask someone who I trust. I called one person. I'm not going to say who. He's 10 times smarter than me. And he speaks in fewer words than I do. So I said what I thought. I was angry and I was fuming. I said, the guy is off the wall. He got me mad. And he said to me, no. He said, what I saw was a frightened man. And he said, our enemies see his fear and they're going to exploit it. Always smarter than me. Always sees things more than I do. Always. And I said, oh my God, by God, he's right. So that's why he was so nervous last night with his programs, offering so many left-wing platitudinous programs, because he was trying to appeal and appease his left-wing fanatic base. He wasn't speaking to the American people. He was speaking to his left-wing fanatical base. He's saying, please support me. I need you now, because those evildoers, the American people, don't like me. Get it? Okay. Well, he wasn't a very good neighbor. Let's put it to you that way, to put it in a very old American thing, you know what I mean? So there it is. Our Magnificent Tongue, The Untold History of English by John McWhorter. I cannot highly recommend it because I haven't read it. And I just found it. I don't know why. See, things jump out of my library here in the Savage Studio. This is my favorite studio of all. It's the oldest one. It's in a basement somewhere. It's because it matches my nature. I don't like a fancy studio, you know, $1 million when they come in and build it for you. Usually like a new syndicated host, the syndicator, oh yes, we're going to build you a fabulous studio. So what? What does it matter what the studio looks like? What's going on in your head? And what you've read, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago and today, and the ability in 1 second with a stroke of like a spark in your brain to put the two together and make people listen because they're enjoying it, because they get something out of it. You get it? So play Topsy Part 1 as I get ready for the callers here on the Savage Nation. And I'll play the cymbal. Actually, I was just playing with two cartridge shells here from a 3006 I found in a drawer. I was clanging two cartridge shells together. I hate throwing out old brass. I always watch war movies. I always wonder about that. You know, you see the machine guns spitting out bullets. And why don't they have a guy in the military who picks up the cartridges and sends them back to St. Louis for reloading instead of leaving them on the ground? You know, so expensive brass. Great metal. I always had a thing with the soft metals. Brass, copper. Dad sold bronze, you know, mixture, so I like copper and brass a lot. Why have I always been drawn to copper and brass? Answer. Because I don't know. Why must everything have an answer? Why do I have to ask so many questions? My head hurts from it already. Why do I care what Obama does? You didn't care. You elected him. I didn't vote for him. You did. I didn't like McCain at all. Right to the last day, I had to support McCain. Because I saw the nightmare coming. I saw the bullet train of Marxism coming down the road. You know, I saw Kalichnikov in the caboose. I saw Carl waving from the first train. Vladimir waving from the second train. I saw it all because I watched Dr. Zhivago in all versions. I lived Dr. Zhivago in all versions. My grandmother ran from Dr. Zhivago in all versions. My grandmother fought against the communists in all versions. My grandfather fled the communists in all versions. He came to America and kissed the earth and died at 47 to give his grandson a better life who he never met. And here I am giving back to the world because I owe it to you. Why? You think I'm going to gain something from this? I'm making enemies every day with this. That's what I ask myself. Who needs this? Disappear. Disappear, disappear, go away, disappear, become a recluse. Buy a house in New Hampshire. Get a house in New Hampshire, disappear, get a little house in New Hampshire. Get a little house up there in New Hampshire, disappear, don't talk to anybody. Doesn't work that way, it's nonsense. I was watching a rerun of The Sopranos last night because there's nothing else I could watch anymore. It's so boring, it's a nightmare. Nothing, that and Mad Men, that's about it. But how many times can you watch Mad Men? The best scene in Mad Men is when she finds out her husband was having an affair, and she gets even and goes to the bar, the Tudor bar in Manhattan, and goes in the toilet with a guy. Oh, good scene. But, it was off base in the sense that she got even with him. In the way, you could believe it, actually, if you're like on an impulse. Two Manhattans and boom, and the guy catches them, and she's humiliated back in Connecticut the rest of her life, or wherever, upstate New York, till she runs off with the bad politician. I don't know where that he's going to... But he deserved it. I mean, that she went in the... He's always the guy at the bar, at least they didn't... You can't pick them up like that. Nothing. Boom. But you could believe it. But you know who's ever running January Jones, who is very much the Grace Kelly of today, destroyed her. When she played the prim New England lady of the 50s, 60s with the gloves, perfect. So they got some psycho nut who said, okay, now we got to show the other side of you. So let's dress you up nude as a slut. End of her career. Goodbye, Charlie. It's over. Nobody wanted to see her as a slut. Why? Because you could see that for nothing on every porn site in America. You didn't want to see January Jones upside down. You understand what I'm saying? You wanted to see her with gloves on and like a white hat on the way to church or the Little League or to the sports field or to polo or to the horse. We always wanted to see her in that role. Never did we want to see her as an upside down cake. We didn't want to see her as an upside down cake. Thank you very much. Who's the sicko who did that to her, I wonder? So I watched Sopranos last night. I don't know what season it is. Actually, I didn't want to watch this one at all. It's when the fat guy, who was secretly gay, gets outed and runs away from them to New Hampshire. It was a very, very sad one of him on the run. I didn't like it at all. It was really heartbreaking. And the next one is when they kill him. I never want to watch that again. It's one of the most horrendous death scenes I've ever seen. It was so awful. But to see this guy have to leave his whole life because of a thing like that was unbelievably terrible. But the point I'm making is that he goes to New Hampshire to hide from Brooklyn or wherever they were, New Jersey, and he gets a job in construction. Remember, he has sex with the guy who makes pancakes up there, whatever. Flips the pancake jack, the machos, like two macho guys. But the point I'm making is the town of New Hampshire that they showed, like a White Mountain Inn, I always thought I'd end up living in like a White Mountain area. When I was a kid, I always wanted to like live in the Adirondacks, or I thought I would own like an inn in the White Mountains, and I'd be like, the little old innkeeper with the bell. I always had like the weird thing, that's why the Catch from the Rye hit me today. Like, what if I had done that? What if I had not read On the Road? And went to Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, the Marquesas, the Palmyras. What if I had walked down that other road, I ask myself, and I was merely an innkeeper in New England today? Who would I be? What would I be? How would I be? Well, it's like Henry Miller. You ever read Henry Miller? Did you ever read Black Spring? Each morning I awaken and 1,000 paths open before my door. Thank you. Hello, Henry. Each morning I awaken and 1,000 paths open before my door. So how do you know what road you're going to go down? Is it fate? Is it a decision? Well, whatever it is, you're on it, my friend. And you may as well enjoy it, and I'll be back.
Savage.
Hare Rama, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
All right, I got out my Tibetan symbols just now in the Savage Nation. We just got a little philosophically on or off track depending on where you're coming from on the Savage Nation. We started out by talking about Obama and The Catcher in the Rye, and I showed the long arc between the Holden Caulfield, The Catcher in the Rye, and Barack Obama still playing the adolescent outsider from beatnik to hippie to progressive. And I hope you've enjoyed it thus far, but I want to conclude because I told you in the last thing about how I thought I'd end up in the Adirondacks or in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, probably as a high school teacher and then an innkeeper with a rock collection in the back, slowly going out of my mind. And I'm going to read now instead, because of the thousand step, the thousand paths before us every day, by the way. It's not just in a life. You walk out the door in the morning, there's a thousand paths you can take. Whether we do it or not is another story. Most of us, of course, don't. But here's The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost, great American poet. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both. And be one traveler long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay, and leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken. So instead of owning an inn in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, I wound up in a rain-sodden, cheap hotel in Suva, Fiji, listening to rain on a tin roof, in between collecting plants in the islands of the Fijis, in Samoa, in Tonga, in Palmyra, in the Marquesas, and listening to music like you're about to hear on the radio in between collections before I went out for lamb curry. Oh, some of my happiest moments. Well, staying there in those wet rooms listening to this bad Indian music. It was amazing. All my friends were either Fijian or Indian. I had the greatest fun listening to each talk about the other. When I'd be with my Fijian friends at night, they would tell me about how bad the Fijians were. When the Fijians and I would get together, they'd tell me how bad the Indians were. I was just simply a graduate student collecting plants. I just shrugged. I had to become the ultimate diplomat. So, Mike, what do you think? Are they no good? What do I know? I know some of them. They're very nice, I would say. And I let it just pass like a bee in the room. I wish some of you could understand that. You don't have to join in. You don't have to become a Democrat hater. 1-800-449-8255. Visit me online at michaelsavage.com. If you get a comment on any of these topics in this hour, you're out of luck because I'm almost out of time. The Road Not Taken. You know, as I leave you in this hour getting ready for the next hour, I'll bet many of you are thinking in your cars, in your homes, in your hospital beds, in your jail cells, trying to imagine where you are, from limousines to broken cars to people working in stores, and God knows the level of humanity out there. But every man is a dreamer. Every man is a dreamer. Every woman is a dreamer. That's what makes us human. Don't turn the dream machine off in your head. Turn it on. Don't be afraid of dreaming. It's only dreams that can save you and save this country from the destitution that some very evil politicians would bring us to. Keep dreaming. That's my advice to you. Don't be afraid of it. Don't get so locked into a rigid doxy that you're stuck and can't dream. Dream! Dream about what you could be. Dream about what your family could be. Dream about what your children could be. And most importantly, for them, dream about what this nation could be after we are through with this fever of the radical experiment with communism that we are going through. After this radical experiment with communism is over, dream about what America could be if we get a genuine, real conservative as opposed to another rhino. Don't let the rhinos gallop back into your head, because once again, they'll trample you just as fast as will the Marxists who are now trampling down the grapes, not of wrath, but the grapes of hope. This is the Savage Nation. I hope you've enjoyed today. I've had quite a ride thus far. Hope you'll be with us for the next big hour on your local station. I want to thank every one of you for listening to this program.
Savage. Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity.
Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Last night after the Obama's State of the Union speech, I could not believe what I had been watching. So I went on to my website and I wrote this. This was right after the speech last night. It's short. It said, "We're all in danger. This man, Obama, is out of touch with the real world. Every conceivable liberal idea, plan, or proposal, even some of them so obscure that they have only circulated in underground college publications, were proposed by him. Obama has no concept of limitations, his own or that of government. As such, he places us all in danger. More tomorrow." Yeah, well, believe me, here is tomorrow. Why do I say that he places us all in danger? Well, it was a speech full of bluster and bombast, unctuous in tone, condescending in spirit. "We don't understand health care," he said. "We don't understand budgeting," he said. "We don't understand the Supreme Court's decision," he said. "The people are idiots. He's brilliant." This was an arrogant and insulting demonstration of the ability of a community organizer to blame the world for his failures. Even the left wing thinks it was muddled. He didn't have a coherent philosophy other than attack, attack, attack. That's why the theme of his speech was, "I don't quit." Now, top Democrats are at war with each other. According to a story that I saw, which we posted on michaelsavage.com, there are signs of strain between Harry Reid and White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, and relations between Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate are now hovering between thinly veiled disdain and outright hostility. I see the Democrats as rattlesnakes fighting in a barrel over a dead rat. Another article on michaelsavage.com. You had to watch the speech last night as Obama insulted the Supreme Court to their faces. The fact is that constitutional scholars are saying this was a very, very insulting moment. It was immature. It was uncalled for to disagree with the Supreme Court like this and then have the Democrats stand up around the Supreme Court justices and applaud all around them as though it was a gang intimidating them. This is the man who said he wants to bring us together. He insulted the Supreme Court to their face. And by the way, they all sat still, including the liberals, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and including Sotomayor. This was unbelievable to watch. What we saw was a little martinet. A little martinet, a self-important dictator, trying to intimidate another and equal branch of government. So it's no wonder that Justice Alito could barely contain his outrage. And you could see him mouthing the words, "not true," as Obama criticized the Supreme Court's decision on campaign finance last night. During the speech, he also called for the repeal of "don't ask, don't tell." Now, here is a military that is fighting a war on two fronts. Here is a military that needs the support of the president, and instead he undermines the president. This is his idea of the most important thing facing America? Our enemies are on the verge of winning. The economy is on the verge of collapse. Our culture has been destroyed by political cowardice and the filth that comes out of Hollywood. But repealing "don't ask, don't tell" is more important to Chairman Obama. Astounding. All you had to do was look at the faces of the military leaders as Obama said he wanted to end don't ask, don't tell, and you'll see what the military actually thinks of this community organizer's collegey idea. John Kerry, sitting in a blizzard in Boston, it's up on michaelsavage.com, sitting in a blizzard in Boston, says that climate change advocates must match Tea Party intensity. He wants them to go out in the street and get angry, I guess after the snow is melted, because the planet is being injured and they're being killed by the weather. This is unbelievable to me. Well, those are some of the stories on michaelsavage.com. There's a couple others I should mention before we go. the Hitler of Iran, the friends of the American media and the American left, the Hitler of Iran, Ahmadinejad, predicts Israel's destruction. In the past, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has called Israel a cancerous tumor that must be wiped from the map. Now, suppose Israel's leader were to predict Iran's destruction. What do you think would happen? Every anti-Semite in the American media would come out and attack the Israeli. But as it is, the leader of Israel will not say that. It seems as though they've lost the guts they once had. They're acting like the little guy who gets pushed around by the bully, and every time he does it, he says, push me one more time, and then you'll get it. And then the bully keeps pushing him, but nothing happens. Here's a sad story. Actor Michael Douglas' son, it's up on Michael Savage, Cameron, will be put in prison for at least 10 years after pleading guilty to dealing large quantities of methamphetamine and cocaine from a trendy Manhattan hotel. This is not a story to be happy about. This is a very sad story that mirrors the decline of America itself. His grandfather, Kirk Douglas, made himself into one of the world's most famous actors, coming from a poor family in upstate New York. An immigrant Jewish family, by the way, from the Ukraine, I believe. So the grandfather, Kirk Douglas, rises from nothing. The son, Michael Douglas, fabulous actor. The greatness that was built up by the first generation has been squandered by the third. And so falls a great American family, as the British used to say, from sandals to sandals in three generations. It's terrible to see this story. It's nothing to crow about unless you're a left-winger, who will certainly get a great deal of a pleasure out of that. Also today, not to be missed, is a lead story up on michaelsavage.com, linked up from breitbart.com. I was quite surprised that this came up on Drudge. Actually, if you go to, it was on, up on Drudge from Breitbart, and it's the top left, and we linked it up on Michael Savage, and it said, Catcher in the Rye author J.D. Salinger dies. Now, he wrote, you know, The Catcher in the Rye, published in 1951, but he was an American icon. He was a very, very important author, in addition to being a popular author. He died at the age of 91 in New Hampshire, in self-imposed isolation in a small, remote house in Cornish, New Hampshire. This book changed America. It was written in 1945, came out in 51 during the time of Cold War conformity, and the rebellious character Holden Caulfield, frankly, was the predator of the beatnik and the hippie, to be very frank with you. And Salinger may have written for adults, but teenagers all over the world identify with the novel's themes of alienation, innocence, and fantasy. What's interesting to me is that Breitbart put up Michael Savage reading The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger on the link to the headline, Catcher in the Rye author J.D. Salinger dies. It's five phenomenal minutes, which were going, and what I said apparently is something that should live in, not infamy, but just live, because it was really well put. The main idea in Catcher in the Rye is the depiction of adolescent alienation and the loss of innocence in the protagonist, Holden Caulfield. Remember, this novel remains widely read and controversial, still selling around 250,000 copies each year. Now, Salinger became a recluse, and he published very infrequently after this. But he followed Catcher with a short story collection, nine stories, a collection of a novella, and a short story, Franny and Zoe, in 1961, a collection of two novellas, Raise High the Roof Beam, Carpenters, and Seymour. His last published work was a novella entitled Hapworth, 16, 1924, which appeared in the New Yorker on June 16, 1965. Salinger died of natural causes on January 27, 2010, at his home in Cornish, New Hampshire. He was 90. How old? He was 91 years old. By the way, Salinger had been born in Manhattan on New Year's Day, 1919. His mother, Marie Jilich, was half Scottish and half Irish. His father, Saul Salinger, was of Polish-Jewish origin, who sold kosher cheese. Salinger's mother changed her name to Miriam and passed as Jewish. Salinger did not find out that his mother was not Jewish until just after his bar mitzvah. That's an amazing story. You're going to hear more about it right here on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
in his weekly report, here is James Herson.
Saul Alinsky, the spiritual leader of the left, in his infamous book, Rules for Radicals, taught the tactic, pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. In his State of the Union campaign speech, Barack Obama picked the wrong target and spouted drivel in his attempt to freeze, personalize, and polarize a Supreme Court decision. A commander-in-chief expressing pointed criticism of a specific Supreme Court decision in a State of the Union address is unprecedented in history. Facing 6 of the 9 justices who were sitting right up front, Obama said, quote, last week, the Supreme Court reversed a century of law. He said, quote, reversed a century of law to open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections. Now, the president was referring to the recent landmark Supreme Court decision striking down limits on corporate political speech. I was an attorney of record who filed arguments in that case. Halfway through the phrase in the president's speech where he was criticizing that decision, Justice Samuel Alito started to shake his head from side to side to express his disagreement. Then the judge mouthed the words, "It's not true." That invoked the memory of Congressman Joe Wilson, who bravely shouted, "You lie," during a pseudo State of the Union speech last year. Alito didn't shout, but his mouthed words may be even louder than Wilson's shouting when you consider Obama's extraordinary demagoguery here. First of all, the court did not overturn a century of law. The legislation the court struck down was 7 years old, the ill-conceived McCain-Feingold campaign finance law that was adopted during the Bush administration. The decision merely restores First Amendment rights to citizens who organize themselves into groups, like nonprofit organizations, as well as corporations and unions. The court said these entities are entitled to the same protection as individual speech. You know, that pesky little thing, the First Amendment. The law Obama may have been referring to was legislation that Congress passed in the early 20th century that prohibited direct corporate contributions to political campaigns. That law was not a part of this case. It was not a part of the case the president was referring to, and that law remains valid. What the court invalidated was the rule that stopped corporations and unions from spending money from their own treasuries rather than having to have political action committees for advertising to advocate for or against a federal candidate in the period immediately before an election. As it existed, the McCain-Feingold law could ban books, films, television shows, and ads. But Keith Olbermann was exempt.
Are you kidding?
That's what lawyers trying to convince the court to keep the law intact admitted. They admitted it on the record in the case. So that brings up a question. Is nobody advising this president as to what is and what is not presidential? Not only have presidents not criticized a specific decision of the Supreme Court in State of the Union addresses, the high court is rarely even brought up, even by presidents that have clashes with the court. President Franklin Roosevelt, one of Obama's supposed role models, never brought up the Supreme Court in any of his numerous State of the Union messages. I mean, this was a president with lots of heated disputes with the judicial branch. Richard Nixon publicly led a crusade against the Earl Warren-led version of the Supreme Court, but Nixon never used the State of the Union speech to voice his criticism toward the justices on the highest bench in the nation.
Exactly.
You know, I cover Hollywood, as you know, and from a Hollywood theatrical point of view, Obama has lost his celebrity luster. His speech patterns and inflections that used to be perceived as fresh and persuasive are now predictable and flat. The public has developed an immunity to this president's soaring rhetoric because they've learned that his actions have not matched his words. He's like the proverbial guest who stayed too long at the party. Obama spent his first year in office in his political capital to promote a government takeover of health care. Yet in his speech, health care was just a single teensy item in a massive catalog of more campaign promises.
I'm sick of this.
Speaking of campaign promises, the president made promises in this speech he knows he can't possibly deliver with the current leaders in Congress. I mean, does anyone really think that the American people will see capital gains tax cuts for small businesses, nuclear energy, offshore drilling, and wait for this one, earmark reform? I mean, these promises come from the same mouth that on 8 occasions promised that healthcare negotiations would be televised on C-SPAN. Yet, you can bet the Obama administration will push hard for his left-wing agenda items, like the so-called healthcare reform, global warming, taxes and regulations, more and more spending, and, of course, treating terrorists like shoplifters. By the way, there was not a word in his speech backtracking from the absurd policy that gives enemy combatants with knowledge of planned terrorist acts the right to remain silent. Maybe that's why one subject was almost ignored in an overly long speech. You know what it was? That of the nation's national security. Guess the people will have to rely on you, Michael, to give us the real State of the Union. Back to you, my friend.
Hey, thanks for the report, James. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things talk radio. That's TRNCentral.com.
You know, Obama's State of the Union speech, he kept talking about things that the left wing was very happy with, including the military, but in ways that the military's not actually happy with. Joining us now from the Heritage Foundation is Mackenzie Eaglin.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. This is a great time to talk about something that I've been looking at over the past year, which is something that was overlooked largely last night in the President's State of the Union address. You know, he briefly and very breezily mentioned the U.S. military's efforts in Afghanistan and saying that the U.S. owes a commitment to our armed forces when they return home from combat. But that was really the extent of his remarks regarding the military. And what a lot of Americans don't know is that the speech last night symbolizes the president's priorities. It was about 85% domestic priorities, and I mean domestic programs, excluding military issues. And the rest is foreign policy, and you know, a sliver of that is focused on the military. Given what the nation has been asking the United States military to do for the past two decades, particularly since 9/11, it certainly requires more than an afterthought. And we often talk about taking care of people and giving them the health care that they need and the benefits that they need. And that is incredibly important, particularly because America has an all-volunteer force today, something we didn't have before Vietnam, and something we've never engaged this long in a protracted war. This is the longest war in the history of the all-volunteer force and the third longest in the history of the country. So while the president talked about the State of the Union last night, I'd like to talk about the state of the U.S. military today. And it's not just the people that are in, which we all, I think, agree are the best trained and the best led in the world, but about what they're using, the things that they fight in, combat vehicles, sail in across the high seas, and fly in, whether to get themselves and their stuff around the world or to defeat aerial and ground threats. Today's military, today's U.S. military, is largely that which President Reagan built. Most of our service members are using high-end systems that were put together and purchased in the 1980s, often with technology in the 1970s. I'd like to say that, you know, we're accustomed to an iPod instant communications culture where I have a GPS in my car and, you know, two to three devices on myself that can tell me everything I need to know, whereas the Army, for example, is stuck in the era of Atari.
No, that's crazy. Sorry, crazy.
This is a really true point, and It's not just the equipment, but also the technology that goes along with it. Let me offer a brief overview of where the military's force structure stands today. Air Force tactical aircraft, the really cool stuff, the fighter jets that we all like to look at, they average an age of over 20 years old. Same thing with the Navy and Marine Corps. They're approaching that. The Army has a whole host of variety of combat vehicles, everything ranging from armored personnel carriers to Bradley fighting vehicles to M1A1 Abrams and everything else. These vehicles range anywhere from 20 to 35 years old with technology that's inside of them that's even older. Helicopters are in the same boat. Chinooks and Hueys are workhorses in Iraq and Afghanistan, 20 and 35 years old respectively. Our shipbuilding isn't also much better with our cruiser class nearing 20 years old. Let's not forget the airlift and other planes that get our troops and equipment around the world. Our C-5 Galaxy transport aircraft is 40 years old, and our tankers are approaching 50 years old, nearly twice the age of their pilot.
Are you kidding?
While compensation for people in the military has continued to rise necessarily in a post-9/11 world, defense investment in modern systems to replace the vast arsenal of the military's platforms, like ships, planes, and tanks, is falling. President Obama is leading that charge. He cut the defense budget and major defense programs last year with no plan to rebuild new systems for the future. What's happening within the defense budget and policy debate is we're mortgaging the future to pay for the present. The president has basically said, Iraq and Afghanistan are our priority, so we will sacrifice any investment in the future. But what happens 5 years from now and the next group of enlistees comes into the military and they don't have those same advantages that today's forces have?
How did we get to this point?
After the Cold War ended, we all remember the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Clinton administration believed that an era of peace was at hand, the end of history. And the president and Congress, admittedly a Republican-controlled Congress, went along with this wrong-headed vision for the future, a very optimistic one. And we cut the military by a full one-third the size of everything, Army divisions from 18 to 10, Navy carrier strike groups, and Air Force air wings. And we cut modernization. That was all throughout the whole 1990s. Well, then 9/11 happened. You might remember former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said you go to the war with the army you had. Well, we had an army and, by extension, a military from the 90s that had been cut dramatically. But then we quadrupled what we were asking of it. We never mobilized for war after 9/11 as a military or as a nation like we did, for example, for World War II. So while we increased defense spending since 9/11, the last president, it was not enough to make up for the shortfalls of the 90s and the fact that two major wars have been ongoing for 8 years. So the last 15 years of collective decisions and the operations tempo of U.S. forces abroad today means that an investment is required for now and the future. If we do not, America is in danger of losing vital capabilities that we've come to take for granted, that we've controlled for the last half century. Things like control of the high seas that ensures the free flow of goods to make sure that you and I have everything that we need when we go to Walmart. It's stocked on the shelves. Sea lines of communication that protect the internet so that we can log on from work and do what we need to do. To space control, to missile defense, to strategic forces and air superiority and everything in between. It's important to invest in the future and the present, and we right now are not doing both.
Well, how about the rest of the world? I don't think China is sitting still.
Well, the U.S. has shifted its defense investment portfolio to a focus on counterinsurgency operations very similar to those that we're undertaking right now in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're decreasing our investment in high-end systems like fighter jets, like next-generation cruisers for the Navy, bombers for the Air Force, even next-generation combat vehicles for the Army. And what we're doing instead is procuring more things that are relevant to today's combat, like unmanned aerial systems, drones, newer helicopters, things like that, when we really need to be doing both, because we are now losing the technological advantage that the U.S. has had for the last half century relative to the rest of the world, particularly Russia and China. I was struck when I met with the member of the Joint Chiefs, the Air Force Chief of Staff, late last year, and he said on the record, McKinsey, the traditional margins of American military technology superiority are declining across the board. And every day that margin shrinks. And sooner or later, we will be overtaken in that realm. And once we are, we no longer maintain that military superiority that is the guarantor of all of our interests around the world, that of our friends and allies, and our troops stationed abroad.
Is there any part of the government showing any sign of hope?
The dilemma right now is that the state of the military, it's hard to explain to the average American. And even here in Washington, where members follow these issues closely, in everyone's minds, the defense budget has been growing since 9/11. Everybody knows that we've been engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our military has very heavily and at great sacrifice. So the budget grew to meet those demands. But remember, we were underfunded going into it. It's hard for many people to think that defense could somehow still be inadequately funded. In fact, if you look at Gallup polling, it shows that most Americans think we spend about four times what we do on defense than we actually do. Most Americans think we spend about 20% of our economy on defense, which would be about $2 trillion, when in fact we spend about $500 billion per year on the military, the core defense budget. Right there shows the public perception gap and the job of policymakers and you and me and everybody who knows this to educate people to say, you know, the standard answer is, give the troops what they need, whatever that is. Well, I'm here to say that right now there is a shortfall. It's not that significant relative to the size of the defense budget, but it's about $30 billion per year. And it's for equipment, not just more people. And that shortfall exists, but there is a disconnect between that reality and getting the message out there to a larger audience. You know, something I like to often point out to people to just starkly symbolize where the U.S. is slipping or choosing not to invest in our defense portfolio and other countries are ramping up, is with regards to the Air Force in particular. You know, the United States Air Force has controlled the skies again for the last half century. In fact, no soldier or Marine has lost their life due to a threat from the air since the Korean War. That's because of the United States Air Force. Right now in the United States, we have only one fighter manufacturer left in the entire country. America last built a bomber over a decade ago, and that facility is now a Walmart. China and Russia, by comparison, have 12 active fighter and bomber production lines open today.
Oh my God.
Something is amiss. We are clearly not investing enough for the future, and we're losing relative to our peers.
Mackenzie Eaglin, thanks again for being on the Savage Nation.
Well, thanks again for having me on. This is an important issue that I hope we can continue to talk about. You know, the debate in Washington is always over domestic priorities, healthcare, Supreme Court, jobs, and all of these are important. But the underpinning of everything of our entire security is the military, and they continue to provide that for us day and night and deserve this kind of conversation. So thanks again.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
Obama the Great gave his State of the Union speech last night, and of all the problems in the world and those that we have in America, what was the most important to him?
This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are. It's the right thing to do.
But it wasn't just that. He took every single left-wing idea that's been hatched in the last 50 years and threw them against the American people's faces.
I'm calling for a new jobs bill tonight.
I'm proposing that we take $30 billion of the money Wall Street banks have repaid, proposing a new small business tax credit,
providing incentives for energy efficiency and clean energy.
We're launching a national export initiative,
reform export controls consistent with national security,
passing a comprehensive energy and climate bill.
This year, I'm eager to help advance the bipartisan effort in the Senate,
launching a national competition to improve our schools,
require every insurance plan to cover preventive care,
creating a national movement to tackle the epidemic of childhood obesity.
We will not continue tax cuts for oil companies.
I'll issue an executive order that will allow us to go forward.
Let's reject the false choice between protecting our people and upholding our values.
We're building a 21st century VA.
Forge a national commitment to support military families.
This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are.
We were sent here to serve our citizens, not our ambitions.
My God, when will it end? Of course, this speech wasn't about Obama. It was about the American people.
I know the anxieties that are out there right now. These struggles are the reason I ran for president. These struggles are what I've witnessed. I hear about them in the letters. I have never been more hopeful about America's future than I am tonight. I hated it. You hated it. I thought I'd get some applause on that one. I realized I'm calling. I'm proposing. I'm also proposing. Well, I do not accept second place.
I took office. I ran for president. I've witnessed. I hear about them. I read. I know.
I'm interested. I'm grateful that I'm eager. You lose. I win.
Needless to say, Obama will still be pushing socialized medicine, even though the voters are screaming for him not to do it.
I didn't choose to tackle this issue to get some legislative victory under my belt. And by now, it should be fairly obvious that I didn't take on health care because it was good politics. I took on health care because the stories I've heard from Americans with pre-existing conditions whose lives depend on getting coverage. None of these reforms will even happen if we don't also reform how we work with one another. Now, I'm not naive. I never thought that the mere fact of my election would usher in peace and harmony and some post-partisan era. I knew that both parties have fed divisions that are deeply entrenched.
And what is Michelle up to?
Our First Lady, Michelle Obama, who this year is creating a national movement to tackle the epidemic of childhood obesity and make kids healthier. Thank you, honey. She gets embarrassed.
Well, maybe she should be thinking about the obesity of the federal government. But the worst was when he talked about the bailouts.
Our most urgent task upon taking office was to shore up the same banks that helped cause this crisis. It was not easy to do. And if there's one thing that has unified Democrats and Republicans and everybody in between, it's that we all hated the bank bailout. I hated it. You hated it. It was about as popular as a root canal.
If you hated them so much, Mr. President, then why did you vote for them as a senator? And today, Nancy Pelosi has been crowing about how she'll pass health care by hook or by crook, no matter what the American people think.
We must pass this legislation, and we must take whatever time it takes to do it. Some things we can do on the side which may not fit into a bigger plan. That doesn't mean that's a substitute for doing comprehensive. It means we will move on many fronts, any front we can. We go through the gate's closed, we'll go over the fence is too high, we'll pole vault in. If that doesn't work, we'll parachute in, but we're going to get health care reform passed for the American people, for their own personal health and economic security, and for the important role that it'll play in reducing the deficit.
Can you believe that? Can you believe that this woman is so hostile and arrogant?
We're talking about the fact that our bills are about 75% the same, perhaps 80. President optimistically says 90. Maybe he knows something I don't know about what will going to happen in the Senate. But then there's some areas where we're not the same and that we have to find a way to move forward. When we're ready, we will bring them to the floor. Right now, we want to see where the Senate will go on its legislation. But we'll have some important announcements about those when we decide what order they will come to the floor. Some of them, I have to say, cannot be done without the basic bill. You know, in other words, you can't really do the insurance reforms unless you have something else that goes with it. Otherwise, the insurance, you have no leverage with the insurance company.
Well, at least the new Republican governor of Virginia gave us some hope. He had some sane words to say to Obama's inanities.
We have serious concerns over the recent steps the administration has taken regarding suspected terrorists. Americans were shocked on Christmas Day to learn of the attempted bombing of a flight to Detroit. This foreign terrorist suspect was given the same legal rights as a U.S. citizen and immediately stopped providing critical intelligence. Senator-elect Scott Brown has said, "We should be spending taxpayer dollars to defeat terrorists, not to protect them."
And to his credit, the governor stood up to Obama's health care plan as well.
Most Americans do not want to turn over the best medical care system in the world to the federal government. Republicans in Congress have offered legislation to reform health care without shifting Medicaid costs to the states, without cutting Medicare, and without raising your taxes. And we will do that by implementing common sense reforms, like letting families and businesses buy health care insurance policies across state lines and ending frivolous lawsuits against doctors and hospitals that drive up the cost of your health care.
But in spite of it all, the illegitimate midstream media still wants to deify Barack, Barack, Barack.
If presidential leadership were only about giving speeches, the jackhammers would already be at work on Mount Rushmore. In many, many ways, this is one of the most conservative speeches that a Democratic president has given since, I think, the middle of Bill Clinton's time.
Oh, schmuck. Schmuck! I got to tell you something funny. 15 years ago when I began, I was on a local station. So I had another career, and I had to trade off what I was going to do, which career I was going to follow. I knew I was a natural. It's like a guy, you know, finds something at a certain age, and he's so good at it that offers come flying at him. But I was a natural from the beginning. But I didn't know if I wanted to do it. I would work for 5 weeks and take a week off every 5 weeks like clockwork. I had to go do my other, you know, consulting thing. I had to travel. And you know what? My audience waited for me for that week. My ratings went through the roof. People don't go away. You could be off the air for a couple of months if you have a following and people will find you again. And I haven't taken a week off that I can remember in years. I don't do it anymore. But truthfully, it's a great way to run a show because it refreshes you after being off for like a whole week and the weekends, and it's demanding. How's my driving? I love those truck signs, you know. He's great.
Savage. Visit TRNCentral.com, your one stop for news and all things.